ladies and gentlemen. It was my fault that we only had part of that Irish. And we were standing outside the door, and Jonas says to me, you know, every time I was asked to sing that aria when I auditioned, they'd say, well, just start halfway through, forget the first part.
Exactly, and start with the talor, and I used to laugh and then say, listen, I mean, if you want to hear High C, I can do it just like that. But if you want to listen to it, to La Bohème, you have to hear the whole aria. So that's why I said, well, yeah, exactly.
So you got your High C. Anyway, listening to that, you would think that there had to be at least a drop of Italian blood in this man. But all the perhaps his parents ran a pizzeria in Munich or somewhere. But I have it on good authority this isn't the case. He's confounded our expectations in many ways, not least with the diversity of the repertoire he sings and the languages he sings in, idiomatically and with great stylistic awareness. And he's sort of challenged the whole concept that you can categorise singers and place them in little boxes according to the repertoire they sing. Jonas, tell us whether there's been pressure during your career to typecast you.
Typecasting is something really, really, I mean, it's very en vogue now, but on one hand, I totally agree. I always say I love the fact that opera is about to change into something, let's say, even more thrilling than it used to be, because it's not only the audio effect of this beautiful music, but you have also the visual thing. But it never should be the number one in casting somebody, because that's why I say typecasting is, I mean, I mean if you only talk about voices and you say this is he's just perfect for he's a mezzo tenor, or this is a Verdi baritone, or this is I don't know, a coloratura soprano or whatever, that's fine. I mean, if somebody feels just great in a certain repertory, and he's maybe afraid of putting a step into something else, or even limited for whatever reason with his vocal abilities to his repertory, then of course it's the best thing to be, to try to achieve being one of the best in this corner, in this box, as you call it.
Or the Germans have a word for it, Fach.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know that.
But I'm just not that type of guy, and first of all, I'm getting bored very easily, and therefore I just don't like spending all the time doing every time the same thing. It's like working in a factory, doing all the time that. There's way more than just perform two or three different parts all over the world.
Well, you're full of surprises. I'm just wondering, tell us a bit about your grounding, your background, your family, because there was music in the family, wasn't there?
There was music, but mostly theoretically, I have to say. So I grew up in Munich. I spent 24 years of my life in Munich. And my family were great opera and classical music lovers. So we had radio or LPs running all day long with classical music. And we had subscriptions to the opera, to all the concert series. And I used to go there as a child.
Do you remember what you saw? Any particular impressions?
Well, the first thing I saw was I was about five and I saw Butterfly, and I was extremely impressed. I remember it was very funny. I just recently chatted with my sister about that. We were sitting both, we were together in that performance, and we were sitting in the first row, orchestra stalls, right next to the conductor. And I was impressed by these voices and the really impressive, huge figures who performed there. And especially, I got really upset she told me about it, because when the people came after for the bowing, for the curtain calls, and I said, you can't bring that lady on. I mean, she just committed suicide. You're ruining the whole story. And my sister has a completely different idea of that. She said, oh, I can remember this lady. She was so poor. And she was sweating and all the white makeup was running around. I didn't see that at all. She had a completely different eye. thanks for that. So you see, I was an opera lover from the very beginning.
Tell us what kind of voice your first teachers thought you were dealing with, because I know you enrolled at the Mozarteum in Salzburg, but in the beginning they thought they were dealing with a different kind of voice, didn't they? And you had some problems of misdirection.
That's true. I mean, I have to say it's one of the most difficult things to figure out what type of voice you really are and what your natural sound of voice is, because of course we are using that voice day by day in talking, but it's something we repeat and we try to imitate from our parents or our relatives, and it's the same thing with singing. You start singing and you try to imitate a sound that you believe is something that you either like, you heard, or you maybe think is the one that is for you. And for me, it was a very Germanish sound, a very light white, clear voice with no lower vibrations at all. And the result was then that I even had no low register at all. I had nothing. I mean, I opened my mouth and it was just.
Did it feel uncomfortable at the time?
It did. Not at the beginning, because when you start singing, when you start practicing, when you just do that for a little while every day, hopefully every day, but even if you do so, I mean, the least you do is like an hour or so, but the real thing starts when you have your first test contract somewhere in an opera house and you're forced or obliged to sing every day for many hours. Then you realize whether it's something comfortable where you can really spend the whole day with, or it is something that is artificial and not to sustain for long. And that's what I realized. So I learned it, let's say, the hard way, because I literally lost my voice on stage. I had a very small part in Possible, one of the whatever Knappen is the word in English, I don't know. One of those four figures that appear on the first act. The tiny little story that Gornemans tells for about 45 minutes. And I have nothing to sing. It's maybe 10 or 11 phrases I do. And one evening I just couldn't go on. And the conductor was looking at me like, it's your turn. and that really made me think that there might be something wrong. but at least I came that far. I survived the whole process at the conservatory and the auditions and so.
So what was the breakthrough? Because one of the characteristics of your voice is this dark, terrific middle voice. Who changed your life in that respect?
I found a teacher through one of my colleagues who felt that I was desperate and I really needed some help. And this guy, an American baritone, finally released my normal voice from the cage, because it was something I was not allowed to. When I did that at music school, everybody would say, "Oh no, don't do that. It's too dark. It's too heavy. You're gonna hurt yourself. You're young. You need to." I can totally understand that, because these things really happen. When somebody is trying to make a way bigger voice out of what is not that much, and the result then is that you start getting the wobble, and within 10 years, you're gone. So I can understand the concerns, but on the other hand, you have to admit that there sometimes are voices that have that character and that have that sound, and if they do, you can't just strangle them and let them sing with half a vocal cord.
It's quite interesting. We spoke a while ago to Juan Diego Flores here, and he had the opposite experience. You know, his teachers were telling him to broaden his voice, to make it bigger, to make it rounder, and of course what his quality was this kind of narrow, very dynamic, brilliant sound, which of course he later discovered. So teachers have a lot to answer for, don't they? They can make terrible, terrible mistakes.
Exactly, that's why I never want to be a teacher. No, because you're absolutely right, it's so difficult to tell. You can give some tips and advice as you say, try this, try that. But to be a real teacher is much more, because you really have to keep the responsibility for several years, and you have to control the people every now and then. It's not that you just come by every 3 months and then do some coachings and you think that's it. Mm. Because that means that your students most of the time will sing uncontrolled and will repeat and learn and do always their mistakes. Mm. So the opposite would be the case, that you try them to not sing almost not sing without having somebody in the audience to listen and to say, don't do that again. Yeah. But that's theory.
We heard your dark, swarthy sound to great effect as Don Jose and Carmen here, and that was a really terrific reading of the part. I mean, it redefined it for many of us, I think, in that one could see the vulnerability of this little boy who really wasn't a man at all, who was still mummy's boy. And there was a feeling of you being very lost in that last terrible scene. Let's just hear, before we talk any more about it, let's just hear the Act One aria, the so-called flower song. Singing that's the most revealing, and there's always an inwardness about what you do, Jonas, that is so affecting. That high B flat there is how often we hear it just sort of hacked out. I never feel you're singing for effect. I always feel as though there's a reason. It comes from somewhere inside. Discuss.
No, I think that's really a target that we should all singers should achieve, because it's as much as you may think with some cleverly planned details you can have the greatest effect. Mm. I think well, at least me as an audience, I immediately see. It's just a trick. It's not for real. And to create an atmosphere that really emotionally touches the audience, it, from my understanding, is only possible if you yourself feel that deep inside. And just like your normal voice when you talk changes slightly when you are in a certain mood, and your friends can tell immediately whether you're in a sad or in a very happy situation, just because there's this slight difference in your tone. And the same thing happens with your voice when you sing. Even though it's maybe not, you can't tell, you can't say, well, it's because there's more ringing or there's more of this and less of that. I think maybe some physics can measure that and tell us later, but who cares?
No, you're right.
The important thing is that it's something that affects your diaphragm, and that's where the voice is controlled, where the air this column lies, where the vibrations go back and forth and are being amplified. Mm-hmm. So. Therefore, there might be, in the ideal case, a direct connection between the vibration that come out from my vertebra and they go into yours, so that you feel it somewhere here.
Yeah.
And that's.
But you're right. You can spot faking a mile off, I think.
I think it's not worth it. I mean, it really is something. It maybe costs less energy to just fake something, but it's not satisfying for the audience, neither it's for you, because it just it doesn't feel right.
And poor Don Jose is really out of his depth, isn't he, with this woman?
Absolutely, and that's what makes this part so interesting and so thrilling, because there's so many different aspects. If you look at it, compared, for instance, to something like Fidelio, Florestan, that I'm also singing, there are not many layers that you can find in his character, because, I mean, he's about to die, starving to death, has been in prison for 3 years with just water and bread and all that sad story. So he has this wild dream of this angel that will come and save him, and the angel appears in form of his wife. So that means he's very surprised, and he can hardly believe it, and then from the surprise turns over into joy
That aria, it's a drama in itself.
Yes, but I mean, the whole thing is, what I was going to say is this, I mean, it's so cannibal, and there's just this one possibility. You can't play Florestan someone with a dark background and with some evil things in here. It just doesn't work, it won't tell. Where something like José, where you start at the beginning as this smart, handsome soldier, that could be the I always say the dream come true son-in-law, and suddenly, even at first, like, you have some doubts and you think, oh, some edgy behaviors, he's a little bit strange, and you just don't know what goes on in his mind. While he's still playing the charming guy, and then this builds up until the last act, where he's really he's a killer now. He's just so desperate and so. Yes. And that's what, as I say, is something that I like much more to have those many layers. I mean, you can play the next time in a little bit different way. And so
I always feel sorry for Michaela, poor thing. She arrives in the first scene, and the first thing he asks is, how's my mother?
No, it's not true. She tells me greetings from my mother. I said, oh, you tell me about my mother. Yeah. Okay. I mean, they know each other from the playground, from kindergarten, or wherever. So that means their relationship, if you call it love, it's something very innocent. Mm-hmm. And that's all he knows about love, and that's why I think it touches him so much, and it actually lets him pull the ground off his feet, because when he realizes what love could be,
because it's almost like a brother and sister with
the wild animal.
Yes. You enjoy the process, obviously, of working on a role in productions. Have you ever had any kind of out and out disputes with directors about the way they see the role or the way they see the show?
Oh, that's, it can happen. I mean, of course. I mean, you have sometimes now I'm in a very good situation where I can ask far in advance who will be the director, or may I, if I don't know him, I can inform myself, or I can meet him and I can talk to him. So, but at the beginning you are just there, and you meet at the first rehearsal, and you realize whether the person has made their homework or not. Sometimes you really have the impression, even till the dress rehearsal, they have no clue about the No, I mean,
scary.
If you have a director doing Othello, and he asks you, or I ask him about this hanky, and you see him do this, and he looks at you, and it's like 10 days before the opening, he says, which hanky, what are you doing? I have my doubts.
Now, you did some masterclasses with the great Hans Hotter.
Oh, yes. Together,
and I'm curious about that, and I wondered what you learned from him, because the next thing we're going to hear is a Richard Strauss song.
Well, you name it. I mean, he was, I would say, the number one source for having first-hand information of Richard Strauss and his background, because not only he knew him in person, they performed together, and also he married the grandniece or something of Strauss. So he was later relative of the family. So therefore, he just had tons of stories to tell. They were all very interesting, very funny, very amazing about certain songs. When you have a song, you say, oh, I would like to sing this, and he says, oh, you know how this came to you? It was just so funny, and like the most beautiful, gorgeous, soft and intimate songs are mostly composed by Strauss after he had a big fight with his wife, and he smashed the door and went to his working office or whatever, the studio, and then he wrote something so beautiful.
Did he give you any as a singer, any technical notes that were useful to you?
Not really technical, I have to say. It was mostly about interpretation, which was very good, and but our voices were just, or maybe even the range of the was completely different, therefore, I mean, maybe some breath, this is also the technical stuff, but it's not really related to the vocal cords itself. But I mean, we were discussing a lot about piano and forte and things like that, because me as a tenor, I like to sing that was his impression, always the high notes, and I would stand there forever, and he said, don't build houses up there, this is a piano song, don't do it, and he would do but it was very, very interesting. I don't want to miss that
one. Well, this is one of those dreamy, beautiful songs we're talking about, Dream in the Twilight, which is a kind of journey to the land of love, really, in two stanzas, that's all. But let's hear it anyway. On the recording there, but what was interesting to me in listening to that, is the simplicity of the delivery, with using less vibrato, and it was just had a much more simple delivery, much more honest. And I suppose in Lieder you can find completely different colours, because there is an intimacy about it.
Exactly.
There's nowhere to hide, but
exactly. There's the most colours I think you find, and hopefully in vocal performance is probably in a lead recital, because first of all we have to, because there's so many emotions in it, they're squeezed into a very small song of maybe three and a half minutes. And second and much more important is you only have the piano with you, which makes it much easier to sing really, really soft, and to display a range of colours that are almost unaudible if you would do it with an orchestra, because just the whole orchestra sound, as soft they are playing, it will cover you. And therefore it's last but not least, what I like most is it's a very spontaneous way of performing, so you can just decide in that split second whether you would do a crescendo, a decrescendo, a subito piano, whatever it is, whatever comes to your mind, or whatever comes through your emotion, is what you do. The pianist just reacts, because he knows it very well, and he can do it just like that. And that's what makes me this maybe the closest I can get. I can get to the perfect poetry of the moment in performing music, because it's not something that you really have to plan far in advance. And as much as you would like to do that on stage, it's just impossible, because the conductor is busy in holding the whole thing together, and he can't just react, and obviously the 90 people in the pit can't realize that you want to do a super piano then. So, well, sorry, too late.
And there's a great immediacy with the audience as well.
It is, and
privy to your personal thoughts.
Exactly. And based on that, then you can use many of those colors that you probably discover while you're performing lead. You can use them in opera. I mean, not all of them, as I said before, but many of them, and they are always, even in the loudest cliché operas, like in the Wagnerian things, that operas where you would expect it to be very, very loud, huge orchestra, big brass things, and even there are moments where the lead way of singing is just not only enough, but perfect.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're about to hear you sing in English. And this raises an interesting question, because I wanted to talk to you about Britain, because I think it would be very interesting to hear you sing something like the Serenade for Tenor, Horn, and String.
Exactly. No, I've done that already, and I've also done many times. I've done the Michelangelo sonnets, which are just gorgeous music. I mean, they are maybe not the most typical Briton, because they are in his Italian, they're so influenced by Italian composers, but they are adorable. They're so romantic and really gorgeous, and maybe I have the possibility someday to do that again.
Mm-hmm. But the Serenade, those poems, are just so intrinsically English, though, aren't they? All that sort of excellently bright sort of stuff.
Yes,
exactly. Yes. Wicked colour as well. Yeah. And what about Peter Grimes? Because I'm thinking to myself, a little bit down the road, I could see
No, why
that.
Not? Exactly.
I could
no,
see
I,
that.
I saw it recently at the Met, the production there, and it's again, it's one of those really interesting characters.
Very.
Why not?
Yeah,
no,
good. Why not? That's the energy. Anyway, here's a little bit of a character from Oberon, Weber's opera, Oberon.
Oh, yeah.
Sir Juan de Bordeaux, chivalrous knight, and it's extraordinary this number, because it's kind of Wagnerian in kind of delivery and chivalry, but it's got a really difficult coloratura as well.
I mean, there are two arias. I mean, this, I think that the one you're hearing now has these Wagnerian stuff in it, but also some blah 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 the kick of the key, like the Italians say.
Yeah.
And but the other aria is only fast and only like this all the time.
Yeah.
So that's probably the major problem of that part, that you have to have both. You have to have the flexibility and the agility to achieve all and sing all the notes in time, and at the same time something that you can sing broadly.
Presumably you work quite hard to maintain that flexibility in your voice.
I do. I mean, I don't need it so often.
No,
but if I do, it's nice to have it. But I mean, honestly, I just recently did something for fun. We had a concert in Cleveland with the Cleveland Orchestra, and the last concert it was snowing, and it was one of those blizzards, and it was snowing half a meter, and a big catastrophe. So not only the audience, but also the orchestra was unable to show up. So there will be some hardliners that definitely come want to see the show. And if it's not the show, the concert we were trying to do, then let's do something else. And Christopher Waldman and me, who were originally performing this Lied von der Erde there, we decided to do some opera arias and duets. And since it was decided about an hour before the show, we could only sing what they had in stock. So we ended up doing Barbiera, the duet Figaro and Count, which I haven't done for at least 10 years. It was very funny to see Franz Welser-Meister, the conductor. He was not conductor, he was sitting in the audience. He was laughing so much. I was trying to get all the coloratura at the same time.
Well, let's hear a flash of coloratura now.